In her new book, Savage Appetites, True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession, Rachel Monroe crafts an illuminating study on women's complicated relationship with crime. Using a combination of personal narrative, on-the-ground reporting, and a sociological examination of violence and media over the past 100 years, she explains why women are so drawn to this genre. As a warning, parts of this interview contain analysis of sensitive topics. We will be discussing the Columbine shooting, which may be difficult for some to listen to. Monroe says her book started as an examination of her own curiosity.
From a very early age, I was just fascinated by these crime stories, and I couldn't quite figure out why. Basically, I started to notice that there were these periods in my life when things felt out of control for some reason, you know, relationship reasons, work reasons, school reasons, you know, family reasons, whatever. Those were the periods when I would really just like want to watch like marathon SVU, read these like, you know, true crime paperbacks, just like really lose myself in these stories. And that seemed really remarkable to me that, you know, when something was going wrong in my life, I wanted to like read about other people going through much, much worse trouble. And it struck me that maybe the whole genre, maybe that my personal experience had something to say about the genre as a whole and its appeal to other people. Because the other reason I wanted to write the book was because, you know, people have wondered and noticed for a long time that true crime draws a primarily female audience, which I think is maybe surprising to a lot of people, but it's been pretty consistent and shown over and over and over again. And the prevailing explanation that I could find when I searched around was that, oh, women like true crime because they're trying to avoid being killed by a serial killer. And that, you know, I'm sure maybe that's like a part of it, but that didn't really speak to the fullness of my own experience. That felt a little reductive, a little too easy. I mean, honestly, it didn't account for the pleasure. And that's a really uncomfortable thing to talk about, right? The idea that these stories, which are about the worst thing that could happen to you, that other people would get entertainment or pleasure or escapism or thrills out of it. But I think that's really there, and we do a disservice to ourselves and to everybody by pretending it's not. So I wanted to kind of look more closely and consider, you know, where that pleasure comes from, what about it feels troubling, what about it feels potentially revelatory, and starting with my own crime funks seemed like a good place to begin.
Savage Appetites profiles four women who are categorized into four separate aspects of a criminal investigation. How did you come up with the structure of your book?
When I was reading those less satisfying articles about why women love true crime, they would often talk about women as if that was like one broad category and, you know, all women were the same way. And it seemed just way too simple. I knew that there were a lot of different things that could make these kinds of stories compelling to people and people related to them in a lot of different ways. And so I wanted to look at women who, like me, were really drawn into these true crime stories and look at some people who maybe are extreme examples of that, because I think the extreme examples can reveal a pattern in a way that the more subtle examples cannot. So I just looked for women who were really different in a lot of ways in terms of their time period. You know, the stories stretch over about, you know, 100 years. Different in terms of their class background, in some cases their race, their political beliefs, how they related to stories of crime. You know, were they kind of tough on crime avengers? Were they thinking about wrongful convictions and critiquing the justice system? So I wanted them to be really different, but united with this crime obsession. And I thought by delving deeply into these four very different stories, I could see where they overlapped with each other, where they overlapped with me, and then where our points of difference were. And so that was really interesting, and I think hopefully it gives a broader picture of what it is that draws women to these stories, rather than just acting like it's, you know, one simple thing for all of us.
I'm not going to lie, I'm kind of obsessed with the nutshell studies, which is what
me
you
too.
Talk about in your first section. Can you explain what the nutshell studies are and who Frances Glessner Lee is?
Yeah, in some ways, the Nutshell studies were really the point of origin for this book, because I became obsessed with them too, you know, over 10 years ago at this point. They are these fascinating little dollhouses. The woman who made them, Frances Glessner Lee, would probably be really angry at me for calling them dollhouses. She did not think of them as dollhouses, but they are, you know, small houses with dolls in them. So, you know,
murder victims,
exactly. Well, that's the twist, is that each of these dollhouses, a lot of them are really cute and kind of dainty in the way that we're used to these small domestic spaces being, but they each have a dead doll in them. And the idea was that these were, she didn't want you to call them dollhouses because she considered them training tools. She made them, she was born in the towards the end of the 19th century, so, and made these in the 1950s mostly. And the idea was that they were training tools to teach police officers to look more closely, to observe with kind of a scientific eye, instead of looking at a crime scene, making assumptions, relying on their bias, getting locked into, you know, oh, this is a woman dead in a seedy hotel. It must be a drug overdose. Or this is an old woman surrounded by love letters. She must have killed herself. So each of the dolls has in its little dollhouse, there are tiny, tiny little clues that if you look carefully, you can figure out if this was an accident, if it was a suicide, if it was natural causes, or if it was murder. But often they sort of, what they look like on the surface is not the truth. So you really have to look carefully and question your assumptions and hold off your judgment to be a good investigator. And that was what she was really committed in, was training people to, police officers specifically, to investigate crime scenes with that kind of rational, scientific, detached mind.
And Frances Glessner Lee actually became an honorary police captain with the New Hampshire State Police, which was unheard of in that time. You talk about the role of police in the early 1900s and how it was in flux at the time, and it was more about social welfare rather than law and order. Can you talk about the role of women in the police?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating thing to learn. Researching the early stages of American policing, particularly in this time that we're having now, where we're kind of questioning what the function of the police is, what they should be called for, what they should not be called for. So it's interesting to look into the history and see, you know, the way that things are now is not what they always have been, and that in the early 20th century, there was much more of a kind of social work orientation, and when women were first, I don't want to say welcomed into the police force, because they often weren't really that welcomed, but when women first began being police officers, the idea was, you know, they're not going to be out there with guns. That would be, you know, unladylike. They're going to essentially act as like social workers out there dealing with runaway children, you know, domestic abuse situations, and they're going to be kind of community caretakers. And so the interesting thing about Frances Glessner Lee is, you know, she was from an incredibly wealthy family in Chicago. And in some cases, you know, in some ways we would think that that makes her a very privileged person, and that's very true. But she probably, if she could have done anything she wanted, I bet she would have loved to be a police officer. She was obsessed with the police. But that was just, for a woman from her class, her gender, that was just really not considered okay. It was, I mean, she wasn't even, her family really kind of prevented her from even going to college. So she had to kind of come at this fascination with crime investigation in this sort of roundabout way, and use her money as leverage. So she did end up getting to, you know, hang around with a lot of police officers, go on ride-alongs. She had a police radio that she would just like listen to the police scanner all the time, and had a lot of friends who were police officers. And some of that was because she was happy to sort of use her money to buy her way into these worlds that would have otherwise been closed to her. But, you know, I think she was in some ways a woman who was very dissatisfied with the opportunities that were available to her. So that was what made her really fascinating to me, how much she did, but how much she also felt really how much sexism kind of defined her life, despite all of the privileges that she had.
What I thought was interesting is that her obsession was positive. I would consider it a positive obsession, her need to insert scientific theory into criminal investigation.
Yeah, totally. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to explore with this book, is that I think the word obsession, it really can go in so many different directions. It can be a real positive, like you're saying. It can, being obsessed with something is how change often happens, right? You know, that's how you become, as she did, a leader in this emerging field of forensic science. Or, you know, I also write in the book about a woman who got involved in a wrongful conviction case. And you really kind of have to be obsessed, as she was, to pursue this case, you know, through the justice system for 20 years to keep that fight going. You need to be obsessed. Otherwise, you would burn out, you would leave it behind. And so obsession is this kind of two-pronged thing where it can drive change, it can be really inspiring, it can make people go above and beyond, but it can also take over your life. It can also certainly have negative connotations too. And so, you know, where do we draw that line? Where is somebody else's obsession, or even our own obsession, too much, was a question I wanted to think about.
Can people see the Nutshell studies now, or are they primarily kept under lock and key in Baltimore?
Yeah, so when I first saw them, and I'm pretty sure still now, they are they're in the private collection of the Maryland Medical Examiner. So unless you're visiting the morgue in Baltimore, you probably won't have a chance to see them, and hopefully you won't have to be doing that. They were on display at the Smithsonian Museum a couple years ago. That was the first time they had all been on public display. And, you know, it's funny, I went to see them. I had seen them in Baltimore, and then I went to see them at the Smithsonian. And it was sort of a shame because it was so crowded. People were so eager to see the Nutshells, which I can totally understand. But you want to be able to kind of spend some time. I mean, you're supposed to. They were designed for you to kind of linger with them, spend the time, look around, kind of crane your head around, peek into all the little corners. And it was so crowded that there really wasn't time for that. So it was sort of a shame. I mean, everybody deserves a private tour if you can find a way to finagle one. But there is a beautiful coffee table book by a photographer who brought them kind of back into prominence. And so in some ways that book allows you to get a better view on all the little details than it would have been if you had seen them at the Smithsonian. So if people are interested, I really recommend that book.
What's the title of that book?
The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death by the photographer Corinne May Botts.
This is 51%. I'm Elizabeth Hill. We are speaking to Rachel Monroe, author of Savage Appetites, True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. After highlighting Frances Glessner Lee, whose obsession had a positive impact on criminal investigation, I asked Monroe about her final profile, Lindsay.
This was really the most disturbing part of the book for me to research and to write, and other people have told me it's the most troubling part to read. So it's good that it's balanced out by some of the more positive obsessions. Lindsay was a young woman living in suburban Chicago. She had graduated from college and, you know, like so many people we hear about, she was kind of floundering. She didn't have a job. She moved back in with her parents, wasn't really sure what she was going to do or where she was going, what was going to happen with her life. She didn't have a lot of friends and spent a ton of time on the computer. And online, she met this guy, James, who lived in Canada, who was very similar, you know, living with his parents, unemployed, kind of at loose ends. And they found each other because they were both involved in online community that a lot of people are kind of shocked to hear that it exists and troubled. It's a fandom for Columbine. So people who are fascinated by, and in some cases celebrate, the Columbine school shooting. And It's an online community that I've been following for a long time, and it's certainly really troubling. You know, you have some people who are fascinated by this crime, maybe because who are not necessarily celebrating what happened, but find themselves very drawn to it. Maybe part of them relates to some element of it. But Lindsay and James were both so alienated, so depressed, that they saw these two school shooters as heroes in a way, and they began chatting online, and slowly over the course of a few weeks, they decided that they would come together and commit a mass shooting of their own, inspired by Columbine.
Your book is not only an investigation into these four women and their obsessions, but it's also a sociological examination. How do you think media and the crime genre has played a part in the violence?
Yeah, that sociological aspect was really important for me to consider, because I think often true crime is treated as kind of like a trashy or voyeuristic genre, and when we do that, when we dismiss it like that, we don't then look at the big impact that these stories can have on our politics, on our policies. These aren't just kind of trashy voyeuristic stories. They really do shape the way that we understand the world. The stories that get big have a huge influence, and Columbine is a huge example of that. I mean, I think people have made the argument, and I think it's a legitimate one, that there were a lot of mistakes in how Columbine was covered initially. And some of this was because there hadn't been that many school shootings up until then, and we didn't really know better, we in the media. But there were certainly issues. If you look back at the news coverage, then a lot of things were done that people have learned better, and the media doesn't really do today. So, you know, naming the shooters, describing what they were wearing, what music they listened to, and all of this was in service of trying to figure out, you know, who were these kids, how could this have happened, but also at the same time, it did function to turn them, for a small segment of the population, into kind of anti-heroes. It made them famous, right? And this is something we see over and over again in our cultures, that, and maybe it's just a universal human thing, that anybody who's famous, even if they're famous for doing terrible, terrible things, is going to attract a contingent of groupies. And that's not an attractive thing about the human nature, but it is something that we see over and over again. And I think when we look back at the Columbine coverage, we see how the media did contribute to that, to these two figures becoming almost legends. And, you know, and another thing that was really interesting to me in looking at how this Columbine fandom arrived online was when I first started looking into it, this was like 2012, it was mostly young girls, like 14-year-old girls on Tumblr talking about how the Columbine shooters were cute. And this shocked and stunned me.
Yeah.
But then I learned it was around that time that American Horror Story, this very popular TV show, had a character, a cute boy character, who was a school shooter. And so a lot of these girls, many of whom were born, you know, after Columbine had happened, were watching this TV show with this very romanticized young man. He's, you know, moody and brooding and violent. And then they go online. And so, you know, it's there's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to want to blame these young people for their really unhealthy obsessions. But we do have to look at how the culture at large is kind of creating, romanticizing these figures, even if they might not admit it. But, you know, if we're creating TV shows with like dreamy school shooters, we can't then, you know, turn around and be like, why are the young girls having crushes on the school shooters? It's like that's we've kind of steered them towards that.
What I thought was interesting was that Lindsay wanted to be a part of a mass shooting. You don't really see many women partaking in planning or executing a mass shooting.
Yeah, definitely. Extremely. And I mean, Lindsay, in some ways, she reminds me of this kind of newer contingent or subset of school shooters that we've been seeing recently, or just mass shooters in general, of the kind of incel. Usually it's a young man who's frustrated with his romantic prospects, and then takes it out in the world in this violent explosion. And Lindsay, although she was a young woman, felt really similar. Like, her romantic feelings, in a weird way, were what drove her hatred of humanity, her feeling that she was not getting the love that she was entitled to get or something. But yeah, I mean, it did set her apart from so many other people in this Columbine fandom. A lot of, you have these young girls who want to love the shooters, and Lindsay was like, why would I want to love them when I can be them?
You mentioned before that this was the hardest section to write. For me, that was really apparent when you were writing about the Halifax Library. Can you go into a little more detail?
Yeah. So the shooting that James and Lindsay planned was supposed to happen in Halifax. It didn't happen. I guess that's a spoiler alert for the book, but I won't say exactly why it didn't happen. But there was a court case, and as part of the court case, their chat logs were released as evidence. And so I went to Halifax and read the chat logs, which were just, you know, over 1,000 pages. And that was really disturbing. It was really troubling to see, to hear, and to read about the mindset that goes into planning a school shooting. Or I guess in this case, it wasn't a school shooting. It was supposed to be a public mass shooting. You know, so often we sometimes these shooters will write a manifesto or something, but it's not usually that revealing. It's usually just kind of their racist rants. But in this case, because it was two people planning it together, and because it was all archived in chat, you know, as far as we can tell, they never talked on the phone. So their entire relationship is happening in these chat logs, their entire planning. You can really follow along as this idea gets introduced kind of as a joke, and then it becomes more serious, and then they're making these plans. And there was just something about spending so many hours steeping myself in their pain and their hate and the violence that they wanted to inflict that really got into my head. And there's, I think that's, you know, why mass shootings are so frightening in a way. Is, I mean, they are terrorism, or they're meant to inflict terror with their randomness. And I was sitting in the library, it was a beautiful new library in downtown Halifax, reading the chat logs, and they were talking about where they were going to shoot people. And James suggested, oh, there's this beautiful new library, we could shoot people in the library. And I was in the library at that very moment. And you know, obviously I knew it didn't happen. That's why I was reading about it. But it's still that feeling that I think a lot of us have, that at any moment it's possible that somebody could burst in with a gun, right? I mean, even though these kinds of shootings still are statistically quite rare, they loom in our heads and our psyches in such a big way. And so that was when I really felt myself affected by it. As a journalist, I sort of had prided myself on being able to read about these things, but not, you know, let them necessarily get into my head. But being in the place where these people were considering, you know, just killing strangers, looking at the people around me, thinking about how things could have gone the other way, yeah, it really, I needed to get out of there.
Yeah. Is there anything else you would like to add?
I think it's really important to talk about when we're talking about true crime, you know, that word true is maybe something we should poke at and question a little bit, because it is really important to note that certain kinds of stories get covered as true crime, and most violence doesn't, right? So disproportionately, true crime covers stories where victims are usually attractive, young, white, middle-class women. And those are not actually the prototypical victims of violence in the United States. So there is a way in which those stories are overrepresented, and a lot of other stories are underrepresented. I think that's really important to think about when we're thinking about true crime. And also, you know, what is the effect of consuming all these stories on our perception of crime? Violent crime has been really plummeting in the United States for the past 2 decades, but there are studies when you ask people, do you feel like crime is going up or down? People almost universally say they feel like it's going up. And there have also been studies that show the more of this crime-oriented content that you consume, the more you think of the world as a violent and dangerous place. So I think that's something that also those of us who enjoy, even in a complex way, these stories have to reckon with is, are we getting a distorted picture of who is really vulnerable in this world? And are we maybe getting an unrealistic idea about danger? Because that can really easily be shifted into advocating for tough on crime policies that contribute to mass incarceration and cause a huge amount of problems, as we're seeing a lot of discussion for now. So true crime is definitely part of that too. And as consumers, I think we must recognize that.
That was author Rachel Monroe speaking about her new book, Savage Appetites: True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession, published by Simon & Schuster. That's our show. I'm Elizabeth Hill. Allison Dunn will be back next week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or any past episodes, visit WAMCpodcasts.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1623.